was to recommend the flu vaccine to pregnant women, which we all kind of scratched our heads and said, what?
The flu vaccine kind of the opposite of the data that they've...
Right, because obviously the flu vaccine, for those listeners who don't know, you know, even though voluntarily, under pressure, the drug companies voluntarily, because there was actually a lot of pressure put on them, to remove thimerosal from most pediatric vaccinations, you know, the flu vaccine, the injectable as opposed to the nasal, does contain a fair amount of thimerosal, I believe 50 micrograms.
Right, maybe we can get some background there, because the MER in thimerosal refers to mercury, and thimerosal is about 50% by weight ethyl mercury.
Right.
And it's been used as a preservative since, I believe, about the 1930s. And the other thing that's important is that you need a preservative if you have a multi-dose vaccine like...
Right, multi-dose vial.
Right, and so that's why they continue to use thimerosal in some vaccines, such as the flu vaccine.
Right, and so with the injectable flu vaccine, for the most part, unless now there's individual dose vials where there might be, there is a fair amount of thimerosal, and hence a fair amount of mercury. And if the CDC's own data showed that the earlier the exposure, either in utero or in life, increases the risk, well, then why would they recommend the flu vaccine? And I have my own theories on that one. And that one would be to do away with obvious regressive autism. I mean, you've got millions of parents around the world saying that my child, and we have evidence, we have video evidence, you know, here's a video of my child the night before their vaccine. They were walking and talking, and here they are, you know, a week later, and they're no longer walking and talking. So, you know, or even the next day, and they're no more walking and talking. And that's regressive autism, and really the push is to kind of do away with regressive autism and say it's all genetic and it happens in utero, which, you know, I trained in pediatrics in the 80s, and I am getting to the answer of your question, by the way, but I trained in pediatrics in the 80s where, you know, autism was, at that point, it was, I think, one in the early 80s, one in 10,000, maybe one in 20,000. Before 1939 or 40-something, it was non-existent for the most part.
Right.
And that's a whole other story, and there's some good books I recommend on the history of it. But, you know, we went to 1 in 10,000 and to now where it's like 1 in 27 in boys and 1 in maybe 60 nationwide. It's a huge jump. And when I was trained, we were taught autism was a regressive, something regressive. You saw it in kids that were like 3.5 to 4. The ages move down as they move down the dates for the vaccinations. And now, of course, the big push is to say that it's genetic and it happens and babies come out that way. And I think that was why it was part of a kind of a cover-up. Like, well, if babies are going to be damaged at some point anyway, they might as well come out damaged, and then there's no obvious regression. And then people stop questioning this issue. So at some point, at that point, I had heard some data based on the CDC documents that were gotten under FOIA.
Mm-hmm.
And between a year and a half ago and possibly, you know, between a year and a half ago and a few months ago, at some point it came out that there was a CDC whistleblower working with Dr. Hooker that had contacted Dr. Hooker. We did not know who it was.
At first, some people who are pro-vaccination probably said that Hooker's making this all up.
Of course.
Where could he have possibly gotten this from? Like, if the CDC had it, how come it's not public, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, and it's interesting that you said pro-vaccination, and let me clarify this, okay? I'm a physician. You know, we've seen drugs come and go, drugs that are on the market that, you know, can be dangerous for many people. And so, you know, if you are warning your patients that Vioxx and Avandi, which, you know, we know the lawsuits over Vioxx and Avandi, they wound up killing many people. There's been many drugs.
Right.
And many drugs can be dangerous, right? So if you talk about the dangers of taking statins, lowering your acetylcholine levels as you get older, which are lowered anyway, contributing to dementia, that does not make you anti-pharma or anti-drugs. Just because you talk about a side effect or an adverse event or all-out dangers, you know, or lack of efficacy in a specific drug does not mean you are against the use of all drugs. However, that is not the case with vaccines. If you are somebody who's concerned about adverse events or certain kids being susceptible, or certain vaccines not actually even being effective,
right,
and you talk about that, then you are suddenly anti-vaccine.
Right. So
and
if
you're crazy, then you're
I'm
horrific.
Right. So let's say I'm a parent, and I just say, you know, I'm just kind of concerned that we're getting so many vaccines in such a short time. I want to spread this out a little bit. Does that make you a crackpot in some people's eyes?
Yeah, I mean, it,
over the line?
You know, I think you have to wonder about those people, though. Like, who are those people? I mean, if somebody's really reasonable and logical,
right,
then they're open to possibilities, right? That possibly, I mean, we're seeing not just autism, we're seeing so many kids with bipolar type 2, with ADD, with ADHD, with asthma, with, you know, we have two documented cases of ALS in teenage girls immediately post Gardasil vaccine, which, you
right.
know, even Medscape published, you know, as most likely being linked to the Gardasil vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all, you know, when I was, again, training in the 80s, I was told we would never, my attendings said we will never, ever, ever recommend the chickenpox vaccine. It was just experimental in those days. We would never, because every vaccine comes with a real serious
right.
risk. And you must look at the risk-benefit ratio, and it would never pan out for chickenpox. No way. That's what I was told.
Right. Right.
That's what I was told. And then what happened was, you know, they wanted to sell it, and nobody was recommending it. Doctors weren't recommending it. And then Merck literally paid sent people in the House and the Senate $15,000 a day at the state level to come to conferences, a day-long conference, to hear and learn about the vaccine so they would vote for it. And there are some state reps that actually went twice. You know, they got paid $30,000 to come hear about the chickenpox vaccine, and to vote for it, right?
Well, I knew that politicians were kind of slow sometimes, so maybe
right.
it wasn't
right.
the $15,000 they wanted. They just didn't quite get it the first time around.
Yeah, maybe. And, of course, what that did was shifted. It reduced chickenpox and increased shingles, and it lowered the age of shingles. And this was predicted by mathematical biologists all over. There were
right.
two big published state, you know, articles that predicted that we would see a shift. And in fact, the CDC funded a post-epidemiological study using the Antelope Valley in California, and they in fact found, and this was Gary Goldman's work, found that yes, chickenpox has been reduced, but shingles has been increased, and so the mortality and morbidity actually has been increased from this virus, not decreased. It's just
right.
in a different form. And when the CDC went to publish it, they published just the first part of his findings, not the second part, which was, so they published just that chickenpox has been reduced. They did
right.
not want to publish the second part. In fact, when he went to publish it, they sent him letters threatening him, and he won because he was funded by the government, by tax dollars, and by law, he was allowed to publish his findings. So this is the kind of shenanigans that happens at the CDC level.
Well,
what was going on under Gerberding.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's go to this statement. So for a couple of years, a year or two, we've got this PhD chemist, you know, his training is not directly related to vaccinations, but he's got a PhD in biochemistry, so he's got
yeah,
to know...
Yeah, he's no slacker, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
he's no slacker.
And his name is Brian Hooker, and he's been secretly talking to this whistleblower, and then all of a sudden, for reasons I don't quite fully understand, we get this statement from William Thompson through a lawyer's office, which, you know, indicates he's being very careful about what he says. Statement of William W. Thompson, Ph.D., regarding the 2004 article examining the possibility of a relationship between MMR vaccine and autism. My name is William Thompson. I am a senior scientist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where I have worked since 1998. I regret that my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article published in the journal Pediatrics. The omitted data suggested that African-American males who received the MMR vaccine before 36 months were at increased risk for autism. Decisions were made regarding which findings to report after the data were collected, and I believe that the final study protocol was not followed. So can
yeah.
you sort of unravel that?
Yeah, isn't that wild? So,
yes.
So here he is admitting that there was foul play. You know, there's a protocol. When you set down a protocol and you have an IRB, which is an internal review board, has to approve, there's a protocol, and you actually have to adhere to your protocol. that's the rule. I mean, I just did a master's in disaster medical management, so I was at back in med school, you know, doing a master's, you know, years after my doctorate level, and had research, and we had an IRB, you know, an internal review board to look at the study that I set up for my master's study, and it took a year to get it approved. It's, you know, they look at your protocol. It's very serious. You cannot stray from your protocol. You would never do that unless you were hiding something.
So, well, let me give an example. So if I was studying a drug and I wanted to, you know, I hypothesized the drug reduced heart attacks. So that's, you know, the approval is, you know, study this drug to see the risk of heart attacks, but I'm also going to gather some other information. And let's say that I do my research and I find that the risk of heart attacks goes up, but there's less cases of diabetes. So then I publish that this drug is effective for diabetes. Like, what ethical rules have I violated by doing that? Or statistical rules?
Right. Well, it depends what you stated in your protocol and your IRB.
Well, I stated going to look for heart attacks.
Right. So you by you know, you'd be breaching your statement, and under an ethical, you'd be making an ethical breach if you did not state that we found, and by the way, if there was a greater risk of diabetes, there would be a greater risk of heart attack because that's such a big cause of it, but I know that's not the point you were making.
Yeah.
The point is that would be a violation, be a violation, and that does it happen all the time in drug development? It happens all the time.
Right.
Does it make it right? No, it doesn't make it right. It's just that we can't police this. And the powers, the regulatory agencies, have been captured by the industry itself, okay? That's the deal. That's the big problem here. We've got regulatory capture, and part of it is that, look, this happened under Julie Gerberding. So for those listeners who don't know, the head of the CDC at the time this was going on was Julie Gerberding. Where did she go right after this? She went into private sector, head of vaccine division at Merck, for I don't know what her salary is, but you can imagine that when you are running the vaccine division at a place like Merck, you're making millions of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from being a federally paid agent, you know, to a big private industry paid agent, and the salary jump is tremendous. And she was rewarded for doing this. I'm sure there was lots of pressure to not let this information out. I mean, here we've got information that there's this big association of an increased risk for autism for African-American males. You know, who received the MMR before age 36. Now, they could have said, let's change the 36 months. Let's change the dates at which these kids receive it. Let's look at, you know, if they get it at 5 years of age. You know, let's see what that does. They could have done a lot of things that would have been better for society. But instead of doing what was better for society, they wanted to hide this because there was already rumor that MMR increased the risk of autism in susceptible individuals.
Right. Now, they did this in kind of a clever way because, I mean, in some cases fraud is kind of crude, like people just make stuff up. But in this case, they just omitted data, and they came up with kind of a clever scheme to omit data by using birth certificates. Like, that seems like
to be honest, I don't understand why, you know, if they said anyone who didn't have a valid Georgia birth certificate was thrown out, why that eliminated up 40% and those people were mostly African-American males, I don't understand that. Like,
well, I think I can probably explain that. Like, I've been interested in the suppression of the vote, and one of the ways you can suppress the vote is by ID laws, because poor people and there's an association between being poor and being black in America. Poor people are less likely to have valid ID because it costs money. You know, they don't mail away why does my kid need a birth certificate? Now, if you're a richer person, you go, well, eventually they're going to need a passport and they're going to need to get into a school.
Well, they need it for school, right? They need it for school.
But, you know, maybe in Georgia, in poorer districts, they don't worry about birth certificates at school. But I think the excuse was that we want to get information off the birth certificate to do other analyses. But as you pointed out, that wasn't the major analysis, so it was just kind of an excuse they cooked up to say, if we restrict, if we sort of pull after the study, eliminate people who don't have this information, then we can justify their elimination.
Well, and I thought maybe that was it, was having the ID issue, and I was under the impression that when your baby leaves the hospital, you get a birth certificate, but it's possible You know, also, if you're not a homeowner and you're moving a lot, then you lose them. Who knows? So if the population, if the African-American population around in Atlanta or around the CDC or wherever they were looking is a poor, lower socioeconomic population, then I could see how that would could be the case.
I mean, I'm just speculating on some of this, but it seems like they obviously found something
right
where they could eliminate a lot of people, and maybe these were kids who were also less well-nourished and less, you know, and therefore more susceptible to damage.
Well, and they did eliminate, but the important thing that I took home was that the author, who was a senior scientist there, felt that it was an intentional omission because prior to omitting that, there was statistically significant information regarding the link between African-American males and the MMR vaccine and autism. And so even though I didn't understand the implications on eliminating those without a valid Georgia birth certificate, I certainly was very clear to me that the senior scientists at the CDC felt that it was an intentional omission and that was to cover up the link. And so that is effectively what he is saying.
Well, I think he worded this very carefully because he said decisions were made regarding which line he's reporting. Now, he doesn't say who made those decisions, so he's not, like, incriminating himself. He's not incriminating maybe his boss or whoever made the decision. He's just saying decisions were made.
Sure.
So he's saying it's intentional, but he's not actually pointing the finger at who was the person who made that decision.
Well, no, of course, and you wouldn't do that in a, you know, this is his lawyer helped him write this.
Right.
He's not going to say that. I mean, no one would make a statement like that. No whistleblower is going to do that.
But,
you know, this is going to happen when there's some hearings.
But he's saying it's intentional. He's saying decisions were made. He's not saying this just happened because we were sloppy or anything. He's saying people...
Absolutely. And the fact that he contacted Dr. Brian Hooker, who already, you know, was... had under FOIA, had requested documents from the CDC, who already was questioning the link. I mean, he wouldn't have contacted him to give him whatever documents he could, which is what I'm assuming happened as well, or guided him within the documents to look at certain things, unless he wanted that to be found, right? So this is, you know, this is significant. We have people on the other side, like, you know, science-based medicine blogger and ORAC and Nurse Velotti and Dorit Rice. We have the usual suspects all saying this doesn't mean anything. They're kind of in denial of his statement. Well, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. People omit data. This is what they're saying. People omit data all the time in research projects, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything. Well, you know, actually, it does. He wasn't following their protocol, and he's saying it was intentionally omitted because they didn't want to show the statistical significance between the MMR and autism in the subgroup. So, you know, they can deny all they want, and unfortunately, the mainstream press is refusing to pick this up for probably many reasons, and one of which is that under non-election years, in a non-election cycle, 70% of all news media outlets are supported by advertising dollars specifically that come from pharma. It's specific. It is drug money that funds our news. And pharma has a huge hold on what happens on the Hill and what happens in mainstream media. And, you know, if you're getting 70% of your advertising dollars from pharma, you're not going to cut the handoff that feeds you. You're just not going to do it. That, and then you've got the CDC also saying, you know, to the heads of the news stations, we don't want you reporting this because we feel it's not in the public's best interest to know the truth because everyone would stop vaccinating and we'd have deadly outbreaks of everything. And so they're using this fear tactic, which I don't believe would happen, by the way, and there's no evidence to show that. And let me tell you that, like, there's parts of California, I believe it's either Malibu or it's in some of the areas around San Francisco and Silicon Valley, where there's a 50% non-vaccinated rate in public school. Those kids are not dying. They're not having deadly outbreaks. Yes, they may get chickenpox or whatever, but that's normal. I got all those diseases, too. They're not dying from these diseases because they're not vaccinating. And as I know this isn't what you asked me, but if you look at more morbidity and mortality rates specifically, pre- and post-vaccination, what the other side likes to do is look at mortality rates in 1900 of measles and these other diseases
right.
compared to mortality rates now, as opposed to looking at the mortality rates of measles the year prior to introducing the measles vaccine
mm-hmm.
and comparing it to now, which it hasn't changed, by the way. So the
right.
mortality rates were already down to where they are now pre-vaccine, or on the if you do regression analysis, already on their way down and very close to where they are now. So you cannot, it is not fair to say what was going on in 1900 when there was not vitamin C in the winter, when people had, many people didn't have access to clean water or sewage. It's kind of like the difference we're seeing in the death rates in Ebola in African cities. In cities where there's sewage and water and they have access to nutrition, the death rate is 40% as opposed to 67% in the cities where they have public toilets that they don't even have access to or clean water. So, you know, we've got, his statement is damning, and we've got mainstream press that has been avoiding to even talk about this,
well,
and it's
I think
such
the
news.
Right, the mainstream press has thoroughly demonized people who have questions about vaccines, and as you say, you don't have to go all the way on vaccines and say all vaccines are bad and I would never vaccinate my child. You just have to make relatively mild statements to cross the line. And also a thing I've noticed about the mainstream press that when they try to be balanced and they have somebody who's opposed to vaccination or has some questions about vaccination, they rarely put on a scientist. They almost always put on a mother, and often parts of their reasons for not vaccinating are religious, moral, cultural, things like that. And so it takes away from, so it makes it look like this is not a scientific issue. It's basically, does a mother who's fundamentalist Christian have the right to not vaccinate her child, as opposed to, does a mother who's done research have the right to not
vaccinate? Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if you know this, I've got a movie that's coming out, a documentary called Bought the Movie. So it's Bought, that's the name of the movie, but if you go on and find it on the internet, it's Bought the Movie. We'll be having it downloadable in September. It'll be coming to the theaters in November. But we look at the issue, not just around vaccination, but pharmaceutical and food, on regulatory capture and on research and how research is actually brought. And I go around the country interviewing scientists and researchers, as well as activists and parents who know their stuff on food, pharma, and vaccines. And it's very clear that there's a lot of research showing that certain kids are susceptible, and that the government has paid many, many families for their child's vaccine damage, which has led to their child's autism and
right.
mental retardation and disabilities.
Right.
And that is just not getting out to the public. And so, you know, we cover this at great length, and not just on the vaccine issue, but on the drug issue. I mean,
right.
this is going on in the drug world. You know, so this is a big problem. This is one whistleblower. I have exchanged emails with a whistleblower. Well, he's not. He's a whistleblower wannabe from Merck, who is afraid to come forward and talk about what they did in their vaccine trials because he signed a gag order, and so they're afraid. Even though they'd be
right.
protected, there's many more people out there who know that there's a lot of shenanigans that goes on with drug trials and vaccine trials
mm-hmm.
And are afraid to come forward. And I can tell you that the funding for our movie, we did three Indiegogo campaigns and raised hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for our documentary, and half of what we raised came in anonymously.
Really? Really? That's
really. Amazing. Anonymously.
People maybe work at drug companies and know this stuff and feel guilty, but they've got a job that pays six figures and they got mortgages.
Seven figures many
sometimes,
times.
Yes.
Yes, seven figures. And even if they've left, they're afraid that they'll be a pariah. Like, they might have left and they're working for a smaller drug company that does one drug. You know, they're not
right.
doing vaccines anymore, or they're doing a specific vaccine, like just Ebola or whatever, and they're afraid to come forward that they'll lose their job, that they'll be considered a pariah, that everybody else at their new corporation will be like, oh, you're going to turn us in if we do something unethical.
Right.
And there is a culture in many institutions. I mean, we see it in the Catholic Church. We've seen it in hospitals where there was a nurse who was killing patients. They moved him to different departments, to other hospitals. They didn't want to blow the whistle. They didn't want attention drawn on the hospital that they had a nurse that was actually killing patients. This is the kind of stuff that happens. So there's that culture that we don't want the public to know that there's a problem. There's the culture of fear-mongering. Like, well, if we let the public know there might be an issue with an adverse event that's serious with this vaccine, then they're not going to want to vaccinate their kids to anything, and we're going to have outbreaks, and we're afraid, and we don't want to admit that we did anything wrong or that we were trying to let the public allay their fears when actually we didn't know what the hell we were talking about.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I got into the vaccine issue in my master's is that I was doing a master's in disaster medical planning and management, and flu vaccine kept coming up. Flu vaccine clinics, like, oh my God, we've got to know how to have a flu vaccine clinic at the drop of a hat. And I did some research on it, and I was like, well, I think we want to think about that because, you know, most people diagnosed with flu don't even have influenza. It's about 7%.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the flu vaccine is not so great anyway, and it's acquired immunity, and really you need innate immunity for battering the flu, and actually your innate immunity is weakened after the flu vaccine, which is why people get sick from the flu vaccine and think they got flu. They're getting flu doesn't mean influenza. They're getting the next bug that comes along because their innate immunity has been weakened for several weeks while it's shifting from what we'd call TH1 to TH2. But the point I'm making is that there's a lot of covering up. And my thing, you know, what my argument was, if we want the public to trust us, if we have to tell the public we need you to do this right now because we're having an epidemic or we're having a terrorist attack or we're suspecting there's going to be a cyclone, you know, a hurricane coming, we need you to do X, Y, and Z, we need the public to trust us.
Mm-hmm.
And how can the public trust health officials and the government if we're lying to them?
I think when I was a science student many years ago, I just innately trusted everything that came out of the health authority, CDC.
Oh, I did too.
I mean, after all, they're not paid like they work for a drug company. They're government, basically government employees, and, you know, they have our best interests at heart. Why would they lie to us? But now I see things a little bit differently.
I went from, you know, running the PCR, I went from being a, you know, when I was a med student and a resident in the PCR, if you came in and you didn't vaccinate your kid, I was, you know, infuriated. And I can tell you, you don't learn anything about vaccines as a pediatrician. They're not trained how they work and the dangers and how they're made and the passages they go through and how some are oncogenic and some aren't. Like, you're not taught any of that. I learned all of that in the last few years since my master's. So it's not true that doctors know more about vaccines than the public. I'm sorry.
Right.
That's just not true. Because
that's true.
Tell me where in your training that happened. It didn't.
Yes. That is true. A lot of things in science. If you do your own research, you probably know more than most MDs because they, you know, theoretically, they know the entire corpus of the medical literature, and obviously they don't. You know, it's whatever they happen to memorize in med school.
Well, but you don't even get it exposed. You're not even exposed to it,
yeah.
By the way. That's one thing. You don't learn much about innate immunity, by the way,
right.
Either. And the other thing is that now what has happened since I went to med school, you know, funding for research has gone from being just from government where here we'll fund this research. It's now private funding.
Mm-hmm.
It's now corporate funding. That's the majority of funding. The chairs are supported. The departments are supported by the drug companies. You're beholden to them, and you don't want to anger them. You don't want to lose your funding. There's so many whistleblowers. Forget about the vaccine community in pharma doing research on drugs where they're actually showing it's killing patients, and somebody comes forward in academia, and they are screwed. Their life is ruined because if they come forward loudly enough, they will, you know, they're going to lose funding for the department, and the department does everything in their power to vilify that researcher so they look like they're crazy because they're beholden to the drug company. So it's all about now everybody wants drug company money, and the federal agents who work at the FDA and the CDC and the NIH are often in a revolving door, especially if they're high up level. And there's a culture in the agencies, if you listen to Dr. Graham, who was a FDA whistleblower, or some of the other whistleblowers from the EPA, you'll hear that there is a culture that, you know, who do you think you work for? You don't work for the people. You work for the industries.
Right.
We work for the industries because those top people are waiting for their lobbying jobs and their rotating door jobs at the private institutions.
Really true. Just a little while ago, I interviewed a beekeeper on the issue of neonicotinoid pesticides.
Neonicotinoid, yeah.
He made the same point that, you know, the FDA and the USDA, which are supposed to be representing farmers and the general public and keeping things...
And the EPA,
EPA and USDA, and they're really representing the industry and their job...
Exactly.
Pesticides approved, to, you know, teach people how to use pesticides. Their job is not to make sure the pesticides are safe, because that just slows things down, and that means that some pesticides are never going to make it to market, which, of course, is, it means chemical companies lose all this money. Can we?
Yeah, I interviewed two people in my film, but on the neonicotinoid issue, and I think one or two of, I think both of them, but for sure one of them will make it in the film. And it was he was actually a very pro pesticide. He designs pesticides. He's an entomologist at Purdue,
okay.
But was very clear that the neonics were really contributing heavily to colony collapse disorder, and that the EPA was just not willing to get behind this and do anything about it, because they just, you know, for the same reasons you said. You know, look, we have an issue with mercury, and we have an issue with aluminum, and I can tell you that at the NIH, I interviewed informally the aluminum head of the aluminum adjuvant office, and Dr. Cedar, who says that aluminum is considered gross, which means generally regarded as safe. But if you actually go to the FDA web pages on aluminum, they talk about aluminum toxicity levels. You know, and you know, people on getting a dialysis, aluminum toxicity is a big issue. Same with, you know, mercury. I mean, mercury is definitely got toxicity levels. It's not generally regarded as safe. And I asked Dr. Cedar, well, how can you tell me that aluminum is generally regarded as safe? What are you basing it on? Oh, it's just a belief. We've been, you know, that was something that the government decided years ago, so we just go by that. I mean, it's just a belief system. And
so can we specifically talk about the MMR vaccine?
Yes,
and
yes, let's talk about MMR.
Why are there risks with that? That's measles, mumps, rubella,
and rubella.
Called Germany.
You know, first of all, it's a attenuated live virus. So you've always got risks with attenuated live virus vaccines, and the risk is that virus might be more powerful and stronger than your immune system. And so you can get a chronic low-lying infection, right? So that's one of the risks. But, you know, part of it is that you're getting it injected into your system. It's not going through droplets in the air where you can get an IgA initial response and an innate immune response, meaning the way you normally are exposed to mumps, measles, or rubella is droplets in the air from another infected person sneezing, coughing, wiping their mouth, touching something, you touch yourself, right? So it goes through your nose, it goes through your mouth. You have mucosal lining with antibodies called IgA that would respond. You know, that's your first line of defense. If it's in the nose or the mouth, it's going to be IgA and innate immunity, natural killer cells, which are very, very, very powerful, right? So that's all part of the immune complex system. It's a very complex adaptive system. It's probably more complex or as complex as the neurological system. And it's not as simple as just taking those things and injecting them into your muscle to get into a capillary to go directly into your bloodstream and bypass the normal part of immunity. So that's a problem with all injectable vaccines that are, especially if they're things that are not blood-to-blood related, like hepatitis B, let's say, which has other issues. But, you know, mumps, measles, and rubella are caught by droplets in the air. So that's one problem, is that it's entering, this virus, which is alive, is now entering your system in a very unnatural way. No way did we evolve through the millennium by getting mumps, measles, or rubella directly exposed into our blood system. That just never happened.
Right.
Okay, so that's problem number one. Then you've got the mercury in it, for the most part. You know, you've got, at the time you had mercury in it, I believe now that in many parts of the world they're still getting it with thimerosal because it's the cheapest way of preserving it. In the States, I believe in most cases you're getting single dose vials that no longer have that in there. But, you know, many people get a low-lying inflammation that can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause low-lying inflammation in the brain, and you can get, I mean, encephalitis is a table injury. So it is, meaning it's listed on the table of injuries accepted by the CDC, accepted by the government. It's even on the drug insert. Encephalitis or inflammation of the brain
is a possible symptom of encephalitis.
You can have seizure, you know, fever, seizures. It can be mild. It can be moderate or severe. You can have neurological deficits, neurological dysfunction. You can have seizures. So, you know, you can have death from encephalitis. It is a possible outcome. That is an accepted possible outcome from a lot of these vaccines, especially the live viral vaccines. You can then shed the virus. So when I was taking care of kids with cancer in the oncology ward, we did not allow children who had recently been vaccinated to come into contact with them because they shed disease. They were the ones that spread disease, not unvaccinated children. We never asked, oh, has your child not been vaccinated? Well, they can't come into the oncology ward. It was, when was the last time your child was vaccinated? And if it was in the last few months, we did not allow them into the oncology ward. So, you know, there's that problem. There's also formaldehyde. I don't know all the ingredients. I don't have the ingredient list in front of me.
Right.
But, number one is that it's a temporary, non-natural way of achieving some form of immunity. Some kids will have antibody production, which in some cases will be protective for a certain period of time. We know that antibody production isn't necessarily provides immunity because there are outbreaks in fully immunized populations at schools where 95% of the kids were vaccinated. Some of them had documented antibodies, and yet they came down with measles. So we know that the vaccine for measles for mumps, particularly for mumps, I mean, we know there's a lawsuit out there right now on the mumps part of the MMR that it was falsified. Two virologists have gone to a law firm by the name of Constantine and Cannon in New York, and this is in my film as well, that say that the mumps antibodies were falsified by Merck, and they were told to not say anything. And we know that there's mumps outbreaks in mostly fully immunized populations. And in, you know, I think it was somewhere in, I don't know if it was Louisiana, it was one of the southern states, there was like 497 kids with mumps in a community. Three had not been vaccinated, and they were latecomers to the outbreak. They did not start the outbreak. They caught mumps from all the vaccinated kids who came down with mumps. So we know that the vaccine for mumps doesn't infer great immunity. In fact, we had the CDC website at the time prior to the lawsuit being filed said that it was 98 or 97% effective in preventing mumps. And the NIH website was calling for researchers to create a new mumps vaccine because it was not effective. This is going on at the same time. And once the lawsuit came forward, the CDC took down that webpage that said that the mumps part of the MMR was 97% effective.
Well, that's an interesting point, because like when I had measles sometime around 1960, it would have been when I was little, you know, what I was told at that time, and I think it's still held today, is that I now have lifetime immunity to measles, so I was never going to get it again. But with the measles vaccine, at first it was like, here's the great measles vaccine, and
and you only needed one dose, by the way, at the beginning.
One dose,
and you have lifetime immunity. And then we realized, well, that's not working. Second, you need two doses. Well, that's not working. Three doses. Well, that's not working. And now, you know, and now they're talking about, well, we need to do fourth doses. We need to re-immunize these adults because they no longer have antibody protection. And the interesting thing you brought up is, you know, it used to be thought that you got measles or pertussis, you know, which is whooping cough, or whatever, chicken pox, and you had lifelong immunity. The reason that may no longer be true is that in the natural thing of, flow of things were that you got 20-year immunity for sure, and then you were always exposed to the next generation. And being exposed to measles after you had measles, or being exposed to pertussis after you had pertussis, or being exposed to chicken pox after you had chicken pox is actually what would boost your immunity, by the way. That is how your antibody levels get boosted by being exposed, which is why shingles was only in the very elderly who typically lived in nursing homes and were not exposed to their grandchildren or great-grandchildren having chicken pox anymore. And the reason, and so that's what kept our antibodies to chicken pox down and even to shingles, was by being exposed to the next generation with chicken pox, and it would boost your antibody levels. And so it's really, we've kind of thrown nature on its head right now because of how we've pushed for vaccinating against everything and getting rid of all these diseases by vaccination. And now we see that we have to add more and more vaccinations because the antibody levels don't last very long. And the bottom line is that the reason people get acute infectious disease illnesses and live through them is not because of that acquired antibody, because if you're first exposed to a infectious disease, you don't have those memory antibodies, okay? Mm. You have innate immunity, you have IgA if it's droplet, you have innate IgM, and you have innate immunity, okay? And that, if your innate immunity system is working well, you will not succumb to disease. It's when it doesn't work well. is when you succumb to disease. And so the antibodies that you get from vaccination are memory antibodies. And so clearly people weren't, you know, when I think in this country, 67, 68 was when we started giving the measles vaccine. Well, mm-hmm. I had measles. My sisters had measles. We didn't see a death rate of 1 in 1,000. That is bull. The 1 in 1,000 is in third world countries where they're in, you know, refugee camps and there's no
vitamin A deficiency.
Vitamin A deficiency.
Yeah.
I was a disaster manager. I worked in Haiti post-quake. I studied disaster management. And even before that, when I was running the PZR, we would see kids with measles. We'd send them home with vitamin A. We didn't tell the parents, oh, your child has a 1 in 1,000 risk of dying, because that wasn't the truth in this country. It hadn't been the truth since 1900. We sent them home with vitamin A and said, keep them at home, you know, keep them happy, keep them hydrated, send them home, no biggie. It was really
Vitamin A is found in a lot of vegetables, right? And there's probably a lot of...
Anything with carotenoids, you know, with orange lycopenes, with red and orange colors, you get right. Vitamin A.
And there's probably a lot of kids who don't like eating their vegetables and a lot of parents who sort of support that lack of vegetables in their diet.
Absolutely, and in the 1900s, in the inner city tenements, you know, who knows what they were eating if they were getting fresh vegetables at all, especially in the winter. You know,
yeah.
I mean, there just wasn't a lot of fresh vegetables. It was mostly carbohydrate with a little bit of meat or meat fat if you were lucky.
Right.
And so, nutrition is a big part of it. And the reason we think, by the way, that the African American boys were more susceptible to autism, and the theory is that there is much greater vitamin D deficiency in darker-skinned people, of course, because dark skin is there to protect you against UV light absorption.
Right.
The way you make vitamin D is UV light absorption, and so it takes a lot longer time in the sun, and if you're in northern latitudes or in school or in daycare and wearing clothes and that outside in shorts and T-shirts and you're dark-skinned, you're not going to absorb as much vitamin D. And so some of the theories that I've seen thrown around, why were African-American males more susceptible to the MMR and autism damage was could wind up being the vitamin D levels being lower.
And it would seem like there would be, you know, room for a lot of research, but it seems to me that the CDC has pushed itself into a corner where they
can't do the research.
They can't, because they have to. They cannot accept any limitations or damage by any vaccines. All vaccines have to be perfect. Therefore, there's nothing to research, right? Except new vaccines for diseases they don't have one for yet.
Exactly. And that's the real shame of it. So that's the real shame. They're so culpable right now because we had all this time. We could have been doing research. We could have halted the vaccine. We could have delayed the vaccine. We could have done research and what was really causing this. We could have given kids vitamin D prior to giving them the vaccine. I mean, there are so many things that we could have done, but they were too busy covering their own asses for their own selfish personal reasons. And to save the program, it's not about saving kids anymore. It's about saving the program. And that is not new. That started with the polio vaccine and the first issues with the polio vaccine. It was all about, you know, suppressing the SB40 stuff that Bernice Eddy found at the FDA, making that go away, telling the drug companies, well, you're allowed to get rid of the allotment of vaccines that have SB40, but try not to make it with SB40 next go around, and we don't want this getting out. It's been about saving their precious program,
right,
and not saving our precious children. And that is the real culpability here, that the CDC and the rest of the and the other agents, governmental agencies that have been in bed with the drug company. And it is the only time that government actually is in business. Well, it has been. I think that's changing. But it has been one of the few times where there is a joint venture between private industry and government. And you see that on that CDC, you know, drug company webpage about vaccines. There is a joint venture going on between the two in that one arena.
And all of these things run down to funding. Like, if they were funded by health outcomes of children, then they'd be losing money every year.
Absolutely.
And they'd be motivated to, we could reduce the rate of autism by delaying and reducing the number of vaccines. Why don't we do that? But now it's like, well, the only way we can make more money for our pals in private industry is to add more vaccines to the schedule and then cover up any damage that's being done. But in your practice as a pediatrician, what's your approach to vaccination?
So I trained in pediatrics. I am not a pediatrician. I left. Mm-hmm. I did not want to be I did not want to be held to what pediatricians are held to, which is that I have to recommend the vaccination schedule. I didn't want to get in trouble with my state. So I am not a pediatrician. I have a general practice in integrative medicine. I see about 40% of my cases are kids. I see a lot of adults. I also trained in adult rehab medicine and then, of course, homeopathy and nutrition and a few other things. But I have always offered my patients if they asked for them, if they requested. So I'm not also primary care. I'm basically a consultant for chronic illness. That's really how I work, and most of my patients come to me from other doctors, from primary care doctors. Oddly enough, they do refer them to me, as do therapists. But the patient has to usually ask, like, I want another way, these drugs aren't working, and then, you know, okay, well, I'll send you to this doctor. So I usually send them back. I don't bill myself as primary care, again, for that very reason. I need the referrals from the primary physician, so I do like to send them back. I do request that they work with me and they honor that this patient should no longer be vaccinated, if that's the case. I am upfront with my patients about the dangers of vaccinations. And anyone with autoimmune problems, I'm very wary to recommend more vaccinations to them because we see autoimmunity increasing as we increase the vaccination schedule. And I actually that was brought to my attention by veterinarians who have a much greater life cycle of animals since they've introduced vaccination. And all 27 veterinarian schools actually rescinded their recommendation of annual vaccines. They got together and decided they were causing more harm than good by over-vaccinating animals, and they've actually rescinded some of these vaccines that had been recommended annually to not be recommended annually. I find that veterinarians are more on the ball with, we have seen increased asthma and rheumatoid arthritis in our horses or asthma in the cats as we've increased the vaccinations, and certainly with cats, there's sarcomas at the site of injection. And in the veterinary medical world, they call vaccines clean or dirty. Clean vaccines don't have aluminum. Dirty vaccines have aluminum. And by the way, mercury was removed, thimerosal was removed out of veterinary vaccinations in the 80s. In the 80s, because of the mad cow and the autism-like behavior and the neurological damage. And that was told to me by a patient who was a veterinarian about 20 years ago. I was in shock. He said, I can't believe there's thimerosal in pediatric vaccines. It was removed. The FDA was forced to remove them, have them removed in the 80s. I think it was about 86, just when we were creating the vaccine court for our damaged children, because of the neurological damage it inferred on the animals. And now we've got mercury. So we have mercury-free vet vaccines. We have clean vet vaccines, which means they're aluminum-free, and dirty ones, which means they have aluminum, because we know they cause a lot of damage to the animal. So, you know, it is such a crazy world out there in terms of, you know, can I, in good ethics, recommend vaccines to my patients? I have to tell them that there's real risks, and they need to know both sides. And it's for them to decide, the parent and the child, if the child's old enough, the child's a teen, the child should have a say in it, but I think the parent ultimately is going to be stuck taking care of this child. And they need to know what the real risks are of getting the disease versus not getting the disease versus getting the disease after you've been vaccinated versus not vaccinated. And I've always offered mercury-free DTs for my patients if they really want them. You know, I will get vaccines for my patients if they really want them. I try to get mercury-free, you know, versions. But I actually don't even do that anymore because since my master's and doing this film, I actually don't want to be personally liable for any contamination. And I was told when I interviewed somebody on the vaccine committee, which it was anonymous, at the FDA, she said that, you know, there's so many viruses contaminating vaccines that you don't really know what you're getting. You don't know if there's prions, if you can't really look for prions. You don't know what viruses you're getting unless you can look for them. And that she would no longer, after being on the committee for several years, take a vaccine. And I had actually just given myself a DT booster going back to Haiti for my third trip.
DT is diphtheria?
The diphtheria tetanus, yeah.
Diphtheria tetanus.
Yeah. It was a journey for me. I went from being furious with patients for not vaccinating to then being aware of side effects and that some kids are going to be damaged, and if they have autoimmunity or autoimmunity in the family, they probably have a greater risk of being damaged, but we needed them, to, you know, now understanding that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes that we don't really understand and that's kept from us. And so we don't even really know the risk. So you can't make a risk-benefit ratio analysis. And in fact, the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a highly recommended, non-pharma funded collaboration worldwide, they do look at vaccinations, and they were what, you know, I read their review of the flu vaccines, which is why I kind of rescinded my backing of the flu vaccine.
Right.
But even at, when they talk about any vaccine, they almost always end with, risk and adverse event studies are not done. We need to do them, and we can't make a proper risk-benefit analysis without the risks being known. And that is the bottom line.
And if there's a fight to deny every adverse event that happens, like somehow people who are vaccinated and get sick afterwards, it was
or
genetic.
Die.
Or
die genetic. On the way home. Die the very same day, like in the HPV vaccine. They die in the same day in many cases. The death rates on the HPV Merck study were so high, even in the placebo group, because the placebo got the aluminum sulfate, but those deaths didn't start happening until 151 days into the 2 years that they studied those kids. But 75% of the deaths that happened in the vaccine group happened in the first 28 days. And they amortized them over 2 years and said it was a normal death rate, which it wasn't. But I'm going to end with this about autism. Yep. There's something called an attributable rate. And if you do stats, if you study statistics for public health, for health, for psych, even for anything, I'm assuming, if you're especially in a graduate level, there's something called attributable rate, which means, you know, to make a statement vaccines don't cause autism means you're saying the attributable rate of vaccines to autism is zero. And in order to make that statement, you have to qualify a mathematical equation. And in the mathematical equation is the rate of autism in the vaccinated minus the rate of autism in the unvaccinated over the rate of autism, so in the vaccinated. So you have to look at, you must look at the rate of autism in the unvaccinated in order to make a statement, vaccines don't cause autism. Or look at kids who never received the MMR versus the MMR in order to say the MMR doesn't cause autism. So you must do that. Now, that has not been done. That study was funded $5 million and defunded by Dr. Insel, who is head of the Interagency Committee on Autism, because he didn't like the optics of it. He didn't like the message it would send. But because it wasn't done, no official, no CDC, no scientist, no anyone with a graduate degree can say in good faith that the attributable rate of vaccines to autism is zero, because no way has that mathematical equation been fulfilled where you have the rate of autism in the exposed, meaning vaccinated, versus the rate of autism in the unexposed, meaning completely unvaccinated. And until you do that, you cannot make a statement about the attributable rate, period.
Right.
Or you are a liar, or you don't know your stats.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think that the stories of parents should be taken a lot more seriously, because, you know, parents, especially mothers, spend close to 24 hours with their children every day, and they notice the smallest thing with their children. They notice that their child has learned a new word. They notice that.
Well, and how about I was taught that you know, when I do I used to run a PZR, right? And I was taught when I was a PZ resident and a
PZR.
You are taught, listen to the parents, especially the mother. If they tell you there's something wrong, there probably is, because the mother knows the best what's going on, right? That's what we're taught. Except now they're saying, well, listen to the mother unless she's talking about vaccines.
Right.
You know, and then don't listen to her. But otherwise, listen to the mother.
That her child regressed after the vaccine. She's not capable of making that observation.
Even when they had video. So, yeah. Exactly. Well, I do want to say again, I'm going to be, you know, outrageous and give myself a plug again.
Please do.
But the movie bought the movie, so it'll be coming out online in the end of the month and at the theaters in November. There'll be a short period. It's available online for download. And my website is disease-reversal.com. That's disease-reversal.com.
I'll include both of those in the show notes.
Yeah, great. So I really enjoyed speaking with you. I hope. I mean, I'm not saying goodbye or getting off the phone. I just wanted to make sure I got my plug in.
We're almost at the end. We're almost at the end of the hour, so pretty soon they'll be waving at me and telling me that I got to get off the air and go on to the next show. But I would like to really thank you for a really illuminating conversation about the CDC vaccine schedule, the CDC vaccine scandal, and the whole issue of vaccines. And it's always good to talk to a highly educated doctor who's, you know, done the research and figured these things out, because we're always told that the only people who are opposed to vaccines are a bunch of crackpots who you know, have irrational beliefs. And
if you're a doctor and you question vaccine safety, they say the same thing. I mean, you know, you're fabulous until you start questioning the safety or the efficacy of vaccinations. And the moment you do that, you are now a nutcase. There's just zero room to have an honest dialogue because they are afraid of what the public would do. It's a zero tolerance to talk about vaccine safety or efficacy whatsoever.
And that last point is a very important one for me, the shutting down of discussion. My researches for WikiSpooks helped me to understand that a Holocaust denier is not, as one might suspect from the etymology of the word, somebody who'd said the Holocaust didn't happen, but it's anybody who calls the details of a Holocaust account into question, anybody who says, let's look at what the evidence tells us. On the subject of free speech, it is interesting that in the wake of Charlie Hebdo, François Hollande, the French Prime Minister, announced that any websites which promote conspiracy theory should be shut down, that challenging what the government says happened is sufficiently threatening that this discourse must not be allowed to take place on the internet. And that tells me that there are few people very, very concerned about this type of open discussion going on in an uncontrolled fashion. If we are allowed to share information and opinions, we might reach conclusions which were unforeseen or foreseen but unwanted. All of this culture of control, to me, keeps coming back to the issue of money. It's easy to say, I don't think these governments are doing us much good and I don't support them, while to the extent that our decisions are influenced by money, we are in practice supporting these institutions. I mean, that chap, Dr. Cutler, who decided to carry out the experiments in Guatemala, he may in his own mind have decided, well, these are only a few people who are going to die here, we're going to take this knowledge and we're going to save a lot of people with it, and it'll be worthwhile in the bigger picture of things. Not that I condone that thinking, but is that the thinking of the CDC and the other people in the health establishment nowadays? Do they even have that mission to promote general well-being and health? Or do they have quite narrowly defined explicit financial motives to say, well, I'm going to get a big backhander from so-and-so if I cover this up, I'm going to be increasing our company's sales if we can get this law changed, prevent that one from being introduced. So the bigger picture for me about this culture of control is more and more value systems being subsumed by the culture of money, which is hierarchically dominated institution. There's no need for the deep state to control X, Y, and Z companies if those companies are operating according to the axioms of economics and are putting their self-interest first. If they control the money system, well then everything and everyone is up for sale. Yes, we still have some kind of law system, some kind of belief that there are values other than the financial ones about not murdering people, not giving them syphilis and so on. But as we've seen, increasingly, this appears to be a legacy system, something which is left as window dressing, but which in practice is not operational. Now that's a point I intend to pursue in a future episode. This and all previous episodes are available for download at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you're interested in documenting the CDC vaccine issue, I'm recommending WikiSpooks as a venue to try and hash this out together. It's like Wikipedia, but we're not restricted by ideas such as the inherent trustworthiness of government authorities and the ability of commercially controlled media to decide what is and what isn't noteworthy. I'm also still looking for volunteers to help with reading a video about Operation Gladio. Contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, if you'd like to get involved.
which will come down.